Ralph Morris was 97 years old when he died. And for most of those 97 years, he left a full and passionate life. I remember when I first met him, at the time he was in his 80s, and he told me a story about his time during the Second World War. One of the highlights of the war for him was taking a jeep from Army headquarters and getting a couple buddies and going away without leave, AWOL. He was subsequently returned, curfewed, cashiered, and lost his sergeant's rank. But he still had a sparkle in his eye when he told me the story. He was a very interesting man. He had been behind the design of the original Mini. As well as that, a wife and two children, a passionate gardener, and he loved his football club, Reading Football Club, or soccer, as we call it here in Canada. And he had watched them climb from the lowly second division up four places to the dizzying heights of the Premier League. But when I knew Ralph, he was getting on. He just recently had to retire his motorcycle to the garage, and he was finding it difficult to walk without the assistance of a cane. And as I knew him, he continued to get older and frailer, and eventually started to exhibit some of the signs of dementia. Now, many of us know that dementia often comes with memory problems. What we might not realize is that aggression is a frequent partner to dementia. And as Ralph got older, he started to lose his temper and to curse. And as the dementia got worse, he lashed out. He lived at that time in his home with his son Brian and daughter-in-law Josefina. And Josefina was a caregiver. She was looking after him. And one day, as she reached over to tend to him, he reached out and struck her. And Brian felt that he really had no choice, that he couldn't have his dad live with him anymore. And at that time, I'm sorry, I'm just noticing, is there something wrong with the sound? Do I need to adjust this? Are we okay? Okay. And at that point, my husband, Tony Morris, Brian's brother, Ralph's son, went over to England to find a care home for his father. He was stricken. He came home and he said, "Wanda, I know this isn't what we would have wanted. I know that's not what he would have wanted, but we have no choice. And this is a good home. It's clean, the staff are friendly, he will be safe there." Ralph was in the home and his condition continued to deteriorate. He started to lose the ability to walk even with his cane and was confined to a wheelchair. And as the dementia increased, he lost his ability to set boundaries. And so that he would take his wheelchair and he started to run, first into objects and furniture, and then into staff and other residents. And the residents of the care home felt that they had no choice. The nurses, what they did, as much for his own safety as the safety of the other residents, is they took the handles of his wheelchair and they raised them and put them on a windowsill so that no matter how hard Ralph tried to move the wheels of the chair, he was immobilized. And then when he tried to crawl out of the wheelchair and to crawl along the floor, as much for his own safety as the safety of the other residents, the staff tied him to the chair. They felt that they had no choice. And that is how he ended the final months of his life. My husband came home to me and said, "Wanda, whatever happens, you cannot let that happen to me." And of course, I do everything my husband says. So I immediately began to research right to die, choice in dying in Canada. And it was at that time that I became involved in the movement several years ago, more recently becoming the executive director of Dying with Dignity Canada. Now, as the executive director, one of my primary tasks is to increase the awareness of people about our organization and to raise our membership profile. And I intuitively knew that where I needed to be was in the churches and fellowships of Unitarian halls, because I suspected that Unitarians would really resonate with the message of dying with dignity, of choice in dying. What I didn't even know at that time is that we, Unitarians, had actually formally passed a resolution in support of choice in dying, and it's reprinted in your order of service. This was passed almost 20 years ago, in 1993, at the height of the Sue Rodriguez case. And what I'd like to do today is share with you four of the primary arguments against choice in dying, and then pull on our Unitarian sources and principles to refute those. One of the primary arguments that is used to argue against choice in dying, to argue against physician-assisted dying or euthanasia, is that all life is sacred. You may be demented, delusional, and diapered, but your life is still holy. As Unitarians, I believe not that we don't treat life as sacred, but that we see beyond life itself to the greater cycle of life. We believe and state in our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of existence of which we all are a part. And life is a key part of that. But so is death. Life, death, renewal, rebirth, and so the story goes. Without that, it would be like all summers and no winter. Okay, that's maybe a bad example. It would be like all day and no sleep. It would be like a cancer that continually grows and grows until it eats its host and all dies. So as much as we regard life as sacred, we regard it as part of a holy cycle, as part of an interdependent web of existence. John Adams said it this way: "There is a ripeness of time for death, regarding others as well as ourselves. When it is reasonable, we should drop off and make room for another growth. When we live our generation out, we should not wish to encroach on another." A second argument against choice in dying is that individuals who choose to die don't really know what they're saying. Either they're depressed or they're suffering from a lack of care. And if we are a caring community, we would look after them and then they would change their mind. Now, first of all, it is important to safeguard against depression. And in the areas, in the jurisdictions where dying with death with dignity legislation has been passed, there are safeguards in place. For example, in Oregon, where the legislation has been in place since 1997, the safeguards include an individual wishing to end their lives has to make at least 3 separate requests, and the first and last requests have to be at least 15 days apart. They have to be seen by at least 2 physicians. They have to be judged mentally competent, and one of the requests has to be in writing. So certainly with those safeguards in place, a person of mentally competent mind can still choose to end their life. And I think here I would refer to our 5th Unitarian principle. The right of conscience and democratic process within our congregations and society at large. And isn't the kernel of the democratic process the right to individual choice? And if I have no choice over my life, what choice do I have? Shouldn't I have choice not only over where I live and where I work and who I marry and how I live and my religion, but also when I choose to die? A third argument against choice in dying is that it's just not necessary, that advances in medication and medical practices have advanced to the point that palliative care is sufficient and nobody need really suffer in their dying. There are a number of critiques of this argument. First of all, although palliative care and hospice care has advanced very much within Canada, many, many people will die without that support. And even in hospice, there are individuals who are choosing to still die. In Oregon, they're dying with death with dignity legislation. about a third of the people that choose to use that legislation are in hospice at the time. So clearly, hospice care is not enough. And when we look at pain, often the definition is very narrow. We can control the pain, we can end the suffering. But suffering isn't necessarily limited to pain. Many people with serious, terminal, life-ending illnesses are suffering from nausea, constant vomiting, severe itching, or a feeling of suffocation. And not just physical symptoms, but often mental ones as well. The feeling that they never wanted to be institutionalized, didn't want to be dependent, didn't want to die slowly through starvation and have their family watch them do that. So suffering can take many forms. I think if we look at our fourth source, it's that of Jewish and Christian teachings, which call us to respond to God's love by loving our neighbors as ourselves. And surely, as we would not want ourselves to suffer, we would not want others to suffer, and we'd work for a society where people have a choice to end their suffering. The fourth argument that I'm going to talk about, and the final one today, is that of protecting the vulnerable. There are certain groups, and in fact, there's a disability group called Not Dead Yet, which argues that if this legislation is passed, it will be used to cull the ranks of the disabled, perhaps to reduce medical costs, and people will be coerced or even forced into dying against their will. What I'd like to point to is our source, which tells us that we look at to the humanist teachings, which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science. So let's look at the results of science. Since legislation has been legalized in Oregon and the Netherlands, there is one study that's published. It was co-authored by Professor Margaret Papps-Batten out of the University of Utah and published in the peer-reviewed British Journal of Medical Ethics. And her hypothesis was that if people are being forced or being coerced into dying, then what we would see in the evidence is that those individuals who've chosen assisted dying would primarily be the unemployed, from vulnerable demographic groups, without health insurance, etc. When she looked at the data, both from Oregon and the Netherlands, she did find one group that seemed to be overrepresented, one group that was using the legislation more than their population would indicate that they would. That group was primarily white, primarily male, primarily university educated, and primarily well off. At Dying with Dignity, one of our programs is a client support program where we help people at the end of their lives. As you may know, suicide in Canada has been a legal option since 1972, and what we do within the framework of laws is we provide information and emotional support to help people who choose to self-determine their lives. And in my work with Dying with Dignity, I've had a chance to meet two of our clients who were choosing to hasten. And while I knew even before I met them that I was very supportive of their choice and I was keen to meet them, what I was really surprised by was how very much I would like these clients. Because these were two, and they were both women, these were two women who had lived their lives with such joy and such passion that when the quality of their lives had ended, they weren't content to continue to live on in the shadow of their former existence. In Unitarianism, we have a principle, our second principle, which says that we need to have justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. I believe that we do absolutely need to have compassion, but that the safeguards work to protect the vulnerable. What we need is compassion to help those who choose to end their lives. To speak briefly of a woman named Elizabeth McDonald who was suffering from MS and she wanted to end her life. Because the laws in Canada didn't support her, she tried to do it herself. One day when her husband was at work, she took an overdose of medication and she didn't die. When she woke up from the sleep / coma, she was in despair. And she turned to her husband and said, "Don't let that happen to me again. I can't try to die alone again." And so he took her, and together they traveled to Switzerland to a clinic called Dignitas, where she was able to get the support to have the death of her choosing. But at what cost? Because she needed to travel while she was still healthy enough, well enough to do so, while she was still healthy enough to take the medication herself. So she and her husband lost precious weeks, maybe even months of her life, and she ended up dying in a strange place away from her home and homeland. So yes, we do need to protect the vulnerable, but how about those of us who are vulnerable because we want to end our suffering? Ronald Dworkin said, "Making someone die in a way that others approves, but he believes a horrifying contradiction of his life, is a devastating, odious form of tyranny." As Unitarians, we have a second source. It's this: that words and deeds of prophetic men and women would challenge us to confront power and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love. Choice in dying is an issue of compassion, and I believe it's also an issue of justice. And I'm just going to quickly share with you the three things that we do at Dying with Dignity in hopes that you too will support us in our mission. Our mission is threefold. First of all, we provide education, public awareness and information to help people plan things like advanced care plans, appointing a substitute decision maker, and knowing all their options so that when the time comes, they're able to have as much as possible a good death. Secondly, I referred to our client support program. This is a program where we help people who have a terminal illness or a progressive incurable physical illness. We help them by providing full information about their options, including options around self-determined dying. And if they want to pursue those options, then as much as possible, we have a staff or professionally trained volunteer with them and their family, their loved ones at their bedside, so that when they choose to go, they don't need to go alone. Finally, we work for changes in the law. We work so that all Canadians will have the right to choose to end their suffering at the end of their life. I have a little sister, a kid sister, whose name is Linda. And Linda has always been a rebel. She had a skateboard when she was six, a motorcycle in her teens, was one of the early snowboarders. So probably not a surprise when one day she came home with a new dog, a Rottweiler. The family was horrified. Rottweilers, those are the most vicious dogs. Except that Sparky just wasn't. The only thing that she really could threaten was a big bowl of dinner. That was a dog that loved to eat. And Linda and Sparky were inseparable for about 13 years. But as is the way with dogs, Sparky got old. She got rheumatism, arthritis in her legs, in her paws. She lost the sight fully in one eye and most of it in another. And then Linda took her to the vet when she wasn't feeling well, and they discovered that Sparky had a mass in her tummy. They tried some chemo and some other interventions, but they didn't work. Linda loved Sparky, and it was so hard for her to think about letting Sparky go. Yet she could see this dog suffering as she looked up at her. So Linda felt she needed to have the courage to say goodbye. And she brought together a few of her family members and loved ones with Sparky. And they sat in a circle. And Linda held Sparky gently in her arms as vet Karen gave her the shot that allowed her to go gently to sleep. And I hope that you will join me in working to change our laws and to make our programs accessible so that each of us can have that option when we're ready to go, to be at home in the arms of our loved ones and go gently to sleep.